GTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next. Support for the morning show comes from Carthage College, home of the Aspire program and its multifaceted approach to career preparation. The new program is designed to cultivate leadership and entrepreneurial skills while empowering each Carthage student to shape a custom career development plan from their first days on campus. Learn more about the Aspire program at carthage.edu/aspire. And we welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. And we welcome you to the morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I am really delighted to be connecting today via Zoom with a colleague from Carthage College, Dr. James Ripley, who is Director of Instrumental Activities at Carthage. He also happens to be the president of the World Association for Symphonic Bands and Ensembles. And he also happens to sit on Carthage's COVID-19 Coordinating Committee, which is the committee that is charged with making some of the trickiest choices when it comes to Carthage reopening as safely as possible this coming fall. And as a matter of fact, he is just back from one more meeting from that committee. He is not the chair, he is not the official spokesperson, but we'll take a little time to ask him just about kind of the general work of that committee and the kind of questions with which they're wrestling. We'll be able to get kind of a global perspective from the connection that he has with colleagues all around the world through the World Association for Symphonic Bands and Ensembles. And we want to, though, especially talk about a study that comes primarily out of the University of Colorado Boulder that was, at least to some extent, sponsored or co-sponsored by the World Association for Symphonic Bands and Ensembles, if I understand correctly. And it is the first really comprehensive study, still in a sense in its infancy, that is examining some of the risks that are specifically involved in making music. That is, when you have singers in close proximity energetically singing, when you have trumpet players and trombone players and flute players in close proximity playing, what kind of risk are we talking about? And what are the possibilities for gathering such musicians safely or with at least a minimizing of the risk that they face? So there's all kinds of things for us to talk about. So, Dr. James Ripley, I appreciate you joining me today on the morning show.
It's my pleasure, Greg. Thank you. There's a lot of topics to discuss along these lines, but the work that's being done both at Colorado and their auxiliary studies happening at Colorado State University and also at the University of Maryland right now, as well as what we're doing at Carthage, I think are important steps for the safety of the students, the faculty, the staff, and the community at large. So it's a tough time, but it's something that we're taking very seriously and cautiously.
Before we get into some of that present day and future stuff, I want to just roll back to the past for a little bit, the relatively recent past, although it seems like a long, long time ago.
Long time ago.
Yeah. Talking about early to mid-March when COVID-19 started to affect all of us in a very direct way. And of course, for staffs and students alike at Gateway and Parkside, and of course Carthage, life in some respects at least kind of ground to a halt, or at least business as usual for sure ground to a halt. I just wonder what those weeks were like for you, finishing out the semester in virtual fashion, particularly as someone who engages in some of the riskiest behavior when it comes to COVID-19, namely working with wind players in the concert band and wind orchestra. What were you able to do with your young musicians in that portion of the semester affected so deeply by COVID-19?
Well, you know, first off, on a personal level, it was a good chance to kind of reestablish priorities, you know, in life and in family, as well as in school. When you get into a work environment that is as all-encompassing as music, and music education can be at times, things blur together pretty quickly. And finding where one part of your life ends and one goes on is sometimes a little hard to parse out. But it was really a good time to see what was the most important things that the college students should still be experiencing. We had a student teacher that was out and trying to complete her work in a very unusual fashion through online. So helping shepherd her through things were important. But particularly with the groups, we were able to do a couple of things that were, I think, really helpful to them. The one was just simply getting together. As we would get together through Zoom, we would also go into breakout rooms with just the sections, and just for, you know, 15 to 20 minutes with a certain topic for them to talk about or maybe play for each other. That gave them a chance to really stay connected, and I think that was really important for all of us. And one of the activities was based around kind of a free improvisation playing as well. So there were some times where they could kind of do some work together, but mostly it was to a recorded background, and then they were making music, hearing the sound through the headphones. We were also able to do a world premiere of a commissioned piece through the a cappella app, which I was really proud of the students for taking the time to do that. A brand new piece of music, which we only had for maybe a couple of months before starting the recording process. So the students worked hard to prepare the music and then to record it so that we could still deliver that world premiere on the scheduled date that we had planned. And then finally, I think the thing that finished up the year with commencement and being able to have the students, the seniors, participate in a way of, again, combining recordings that they were mixed down by our good friend Dmitry Shapovalov, so that it could be presented for the Carthage commencement. All those things allowed us to stay connected, even though very distant.
Mm. Fantastic. I actually didn't know most of what you just described. I guess I was so busy with my own thing that didn't lift my head far enough or long enough to be aware of all those wonderful things going on in the instrumental side. That's terrific. I want to be sure to ask you, before we get into the study that we're going to explore, talk a moment about the committee that you are sitting on, the COVID-19 coordinating committee. First of all, if it's not too personal a question, did they go looking for you, or did this opportunity arise and did you go after it? I mean, were you on that committee because you, in a sense, wanted to be, or more, were you more or less drafted? Not that there's anything wrong with that.
I'm sure I was drafted. This was not something that I went looking to do, but there were things that probably prompted the invitation, which came from the president and then the chair of the committee, Megan Massonet. When we first started exploring the possibilities of playing in school, I had actually gotten together with my wife, and we stepped out what I believed would be a safe distance of performance, not only outside, but also in the chapel and in the band room, and just to see where we could actually put things and where we could place the people, and to do a lot of pre-planning along those lines. And I sent out diagrams to the provost and the president and saying, you know, I think this is something that we can do. And probably that initiative of knowing that I was looking at the big picture of how to operate safely gave them the idea that I might be able to help in this regard. So I probably dug my own grave in that case.
So give us some sense of the scope of questions that this committee is seeking to answer, or maybe the kind of the breadth of challenges that they are, in a sense, kind of confronting and wrestling with in terms of what Carthage should do.
A lot of the work was given to us by an earlier committee who looked at the best ways to open up, and they gave us some recommendations. And then our job is really implementing those recommendations. They fall along the lines of testing, not only ways to make sure that the students are safe as they come to campus, but then also ways that we can continue testing while everyone is here on campus. There is a element that looks at simply the facilities and ways to change the air handling. We're using some very high-tech UV elements that will be in place in the air handling units to actually kill the virus. College made a good investment to make that happen. So aside from the facilities angle, there's also just the scheduling, which has to be taken into account, which basically comes into making sure there's enough time for cleaning, as well as the air handling to happen in between classes. Things like just the number of people that should be in a room are taken into account. Number of people in a gathering are all under consideration. So those are the primary areas of focus, though. And then ways to provide the materials to the staff who will be working with the cleaning, as well as for the students, handling everything from masks to wiping cloths. Everything is kind of being looked at as far as what you might need to do. But those are the big areas: testing, facilities, scheduling.
Is this an advisory committee, or is this a group of people that, in a sense, has the authority to create policy for the college?
I think this is a policy producing organization. What we're coming up with are things that are being followed, and we're able to do that because it's a cross section of our community that's involved in this committee. Abby Hanna, who is really the person that oversees quality control at Carthage, as well as Ted Ferris, who is our facilities overseer. He looks at all of those kinds of things. Megan Mazinet, who coordinates our scheduling across campus and conferences, as well as we have representatives of athletics, student life, myself as far as fine arts activities, and Deanna Burns, who is one of our deans, but also a faculty representative within this. So many different facets are involved. And when we sit down, we're talking about making a decision for the college, yes.
For those of you just joining us, I am speaking today on the morning show with Dr. James Ripley, who is Director of Instrumental Activities at Carthage College. He's been on the morning show any number of times, but I dare say we've never had a conversation like this one, because the world has never been like it is right now, and life has never been like it is right now for working musicians and for educators in the field of music. So much is different right now, and Dr. Ripley is bringing, as you can already tell, several different really valuable perspectives on a lot of this. So one of the primary things I wanted to explore with you is a very important study that is coming out of the University of Colorado Boulder. Ahead of that, I want to talk for a moment about this organization for which you are the president, the World Association for Symphonic Bands and Ensembles. I'd like you to tell our listeners when you became president of this organization and what this organization is all about, and to what extent it is truly a worldwide global organization.
So our organization has approximately 1,000 members, countries in every continent except Antarctica are represented. The members come from primarily conductors and teachers of music. That varies in its context depending upon what part of the world you're in. Certainly in North America, there is a lot of music educators, but there are just as many that are involved in community and professional groups in Europe. So it's not the same as what you might think as far as a music educators organization, but a large proportion are conductors. We also have a number of representatives from the publishing industry, instrument manufacturers, as well as composers who make up a large percentage of our membership as well. And we get together only every other year as a general membership with everyone. But we have a very active website and a number of different projects that are in place throughout the world that provide information and largely ways to promote bands and bands music is the basic mission of what we have done now in our 40th year. It began with a number of people. They got together in Boston, Massachusetts to decide about ways to bring people together through music. And that's one of the great things that we've always looked at with our purpose as musicians, is it's bringing people together. And WASBE lets us bring people together from all over the world. Our board has met actually quite frequently. We've probably met at least once a week since the end of May.
Wow.
With various things. So the pandemic's also put us on Zoom, which made it actually a little easier to get together than what we had normally had the opportunity before.
Right. I would love to hear a little bit about the kinds of questions and concerns and perspectives and suggestions, whatever, that have come in a sense from afar. Given that you are talking about connecting with all kinds of band people all over the world, and of course this COVID-19 crisis is a pandemic that is affecting the whole world, including musicians all over the world. So are they feeling this very much the same way that we are, or are their experiences in a sense maybe strikingly different in some ways?
That divides pretty equally by the hemisphere right now. Because the northern hemisphere is enjoying some warmer weather, outdoor music making, especially in Europe right now, is starting to engage again. There were actually a number of school groups in Europe that were actually able to finish their school year with some rehearsals as well. Germany, Finland, and Sweden were already coming back to some music making in the schools. They're now on their holiday. But their school year was just finishing up last week in many places in Europe.
Wow.
So the community bands also are very active and are, again, making music. But they have also agreed to distance themselves more than what they would be normally outside. And the groups that are gathering to listen to those are also smaller, just as far as keeping mindful of the respect for others. So they're seeing a return. Southern Hemisphere, it's cooler there, so there's not too much happening in Australia right now, or in the southern part of South America. Brazil is largely kind of shut down with things, with music. So I think the thing that's been the most encouraging is that everywhere is affected. Everybody is mindful of wanting to operate safely. And it's just in those countries where things have gotten under control a little bit more than here in the U.S. that actual music making is happening.
Nice to know it's happening someplace. That's sort of encouraging in a sense. So we want to talk about this major study out of the University of Colorado Boulder. And I think another lead scientist is actually from the University of Maryland, but for some reason it seems to be talked about quite a lot as the study out of Boulder. And we want to explore a little bit of what was explored in this, which is actually, I think, officially known as the International Coalition Performing Arts Aerosol Study. So actually nowhere in that title are the words COVID-19, but obviously it is prompted by the pandemic. So first of all, tell us about how this study came together. That is, who and what helped to launch it, and the role of the organization for which you are the president, the role that it had in making this study possible.
So the two main driving forces in this are both at Boulder. And the one element that really got it started was a gentleman who had seen and wanted to study the case in Washington State where a choir had gotten together with an infected person, which then spread throughout that choir in a long rehearsal, so that it was around three quarters of the choir that was infected within that experience. And so he wanted to study that within his own discipline. And then he got in touch with Shelley Miller, who's the name that we hear the most in this study, because her field is actually in engineering and room engineering. So to create the sense of what the airflow would do within a closed space was something that Shelley then undertook the processes, because she had already been working in those kinds of studies already. And so combined, there were two things that came out. The one was called the COVID estimator, which is not talked about very often, but this was a way to look at the size of a room with the kind of air handling that was in it, the number of people that might be in a room, and also how many instructors were in a room, because it was set up as a school study, and then to actually estimate the amount of people that might be infected with the circumstances of having, one person come in. And so that's largely been put to the side because we have other guidelines as far as how many people are supposed to be in a room anyway. And so we know, half capacity or certain kinds of things are in place. But that is another thing that's come out of this process, which also goes to estimating a full subway system or a restaurant or even a college campus. And I wouldn't want to jinx anything as far as the fall goes, but putting in the numbers with Carthage College, we look just fine as far as the risk. It doesn't mean that there won't be any cases that come onto our campus, but the size and the protocols look to be good that we'll be fine. We wouldn't be having the students come back if we weren't going to be in good shape. So that's one thing. The other thing that Shelley did was then to set up the room instruments, and in that case, I mean the protocol and the actual machines that are used to measure the different kinds of musical activity that is being taken place. And then there was other musicians who came in to actually create the sounds which were measured by Shelley's processes. So there's a lot of moving parts to this, but that's the basic framework, and how it got started was to how to operate as safely as possible within a rehearsal and what mitigation techniques might be used. So things like masks, et cetera.
Right. So in other words, for all of the study that has occurred about COVID-19, in a relatively short amount of time, I mean, of course, this just began in a sense yesterday, but this particular study very much focused on musical activity and trying to study the ways in which playing wind instruments and or singing could be a factor, and just how risky those activities are with no measures in place versus the mitigation of risk if certain safeguards are put in. But I mean, as far as I know, this is the first concerted study with music making as its focus. As far as you know, is that right?
It's the first one that really is taking very careful steps to check and recheck and use a controlled environment with pre-existing kinds of testing techniques. There were a number of studies that were done earlier meaning in April and May in Europe, and those were all undertaken largely by musical organizations that were, you know, interested in making sure that things were safe, but honestly with a little bit of an agenda to say, yeah, this is going to work. So they were good studies, but they weren't particularly scientific studies. And they did give us some information to get started, but this is really the first study, and it will actually take 6 months to be culminated and completed. But it is the first one. The idea for getting it started as quickly as we could was actually for some of the marching bands who wanted to get going during the summer and to find out if that was actually going to be a safe proposition. So initially the focus was on instruments, playing both indoors and outdoors. And then we also got information about singing as well in an early stage. And there were some interesting results with all of those parameters that were examined.
So let's dig into a few of the specific things that this study looked at and the kind of information that is already available even at this early point. I mean, we're talking about roughly 1 month into a 6 month study, and so some of these results, of course, could change a little bit over time. So as probably most of our listeners know, there is this thing called aerosols, which are the tiniest of particles that we as human beings emit. And when we sing and when we play wind instruments, we are emitting quite a few aerosols. And it appears that the virus can be carried not only by big water droplets, but even by these tiny aerosols. So my understanding is that this study tried to examine a variety of wind instruments and to see, in a sense, which instruments were the most serious offenders, shall we say, when it comes to emission of aerosol as these instruments are played. Can you kind of talk us through this matter of aerosols with the various wind instruments?
I'll do my best. The things that the study was focused on were mitigation techniques. And in order to find the best ways to restrict the motion, they closed off the openings on some of the instruments. So, for example, over the trumpet bell, clarinet bell, flute actually emits aerosols from a number of different locations. We were looking thoughtfully at the embouchure hole, and as a player would blow across the flute, that was thought to be pretty significant. But we also found out that there was air movement at the end of the flute as well. Clarinet was studied in the first go round, as was horn, the French horn sometimes as it's known, because that bell is open with the hand placed normally just to the side of the opening. And so to actually cover that bell was thought to be something worth considering. So they were kind of looking at what they thought would be the main complications early on with those instruments. And the things that also were looked at in a different fashion was the trombone. That was set up as a distancing issue because with the slide being fully extended into what's known as the seventh position, when it's all the way out making that start of the glissando sound we love, there's a water key at the end of that slide. And sometimes that water key isn't as solidly sealed. And so just to be on the safe side, it was considered that actually 9 feet away from that a trombone player was a better choice rather than the 6 feet that we've become accustomed to. Actually, another thing that's interesting about this is that the higher pitched sounds seem to travel faster and more directly and therefore have a higher impact than the lower sound. So even as much air as might seem to be put into a tuba, there's not too much coming out of the bell at all. And what does come out doesn't move very quickly in any direction.
No.
The things that seemed to spike the most in the testing were the trumpet, still the flute, and you get a kick out of this one, Greg, in the singing, the one word that was in a song that actually had the hardest kind of effect was the word love. So we can't sing about love this year, I guess.
or not with high notes, at least.
Right. Or at least if we can do it, we'll do it with a mask.
Right. Interesting. So they were examining and sort of confirming when somebody plays the flute or somebody plays the clarinet or plays the trumpet, where do the aerosols emerge? And, right. And of course, primarily it's out of the like the bell of the trumpet, the bell of the clarinet, and so on. Although apparently it can emerge from other parts of the instrument as well, maybe less significant. Right. And so now the study examined ways that some of these could be covered. For instance, the bell of the trumpet or the bell of the clarinet and maybe other parts of the flute could be covered in such a way that not as many aerosols would escape into the air. What kind of coverings are we talking about?
Nylons, nylon stockings, pantyhose. As scientifically engineered as all of the room was, the actual mitigation techniques, since we didn't have anything in production, were best guesses as far as what we could assume might work. And so one of the things that's been in place for a number of years is on a sousaphone, the marching tuba that faces towards the front and is worn over the shoulder, there's a lot of times when there have been bands that have put a covering over that with like the school logo. And right. that kind of nylon cover allows the sound to still travel, but you have this like visual effect. And so that was kind of the first thought, was why don't we just put a nylon covering over the bell. It actually started with an earlier example, which was simple saran wrap, to just have some plastic wrap over the bell of a trumpet. That seemed to work, but there was a little bit of a buzz, you know, as you might imagine with saran wrap. So the nylon seemed to work. I don't buy a lot of nylons, but I'm told that they're in different weights, called a denier, maybe, D-E-N-E-I-R, something like that. And so they used 80 denier nylons, and they put two of them together to drape over the openings of the clarinet bell, the trumpet bell, the trombone bell. So they were nylons. Hmm. And then the rest of what they were using were just simple surgical masks. So one of the things that was tested was to have the flute simply playing with a surgical mask. Nothing special outside of that. Same thing, the brass instruments and the clarinet were playing with masks, but with a hole cut into the mask slightly, just enough so that the mouthpiece can go through it. And those were the basic mitigation techniques that were used. Vocalist was just using a simple surgical mask again.
And so this study was trying to determine, I suppose, first of all, whether or not the emission of aerosols or the dispersal of aerosols into the air would be limited by these kind of measures. And then I suppose, if so, by how much? I mean, does it make a difference that is significant and that in fact reduces risk? So what do we know about that question right now, about to what extent these kind of measures do in fact drop the risk?
Well, and that's where we have the qualified good news. All of these being preliminary considerations and results, they're very careful about saying these are not they've not been subjected to retesting yet, but the preliminary results are really very good, and I can boil it down into just a few things. The one is wearing a mask and while singing actually takes the level down to almost the same level as if you would be speaking. Hmm. That it doesn't actually adversely create extra complications as what was initially thought. But you have to wear a mask. All of those spikes that we talked about are very much taken care of, again, by just simply having the mask to restrict the motion. I think the best news on the instrumental side from this was that the flute actually moderated better than most of the other instruments with the by having the mask in front of it. Coming out the end of the bell, or at the end of the flute, that needed a flute sock to be put in place to also mitigate the emission of the aerosols. By using the coverings, by using the masks, everything comes down to almost the same as just regular speech. And so the watchword really is in two regards. The one is the degree of loudness, the projection element is a huge consideration. That actually is more complicated than playing with an instrument, that the degree of loudness does change things a little bit to the negative side. And so in a rehearsal, the students are going to need to, as well as the instructors, are going to need to know that their manner of communication needs to be very much in just a normal conversational voice. And that there won't be times to really talk extensively outside of the music making experience. You know, everything just needs to be much more cautious and covered. And then also the amount of time makes a difference here as well, as far as the transmission of aerosols.
So in other words, it makes sense for rehearsals to perhaps be shorter in length than they might otherwise be.
Exactly. That was another thing that was studied fairly extensively. There was one room which the air handling had the air coming from an upper level and going out a lower level. There was another room that had the air coming from a lower level in and then going out another higher level, just to see if that made a difference. Again, this was a room engineer that was taking this into account, so she was very concerned about what that result might be and if they were different. And then also outdoor. And what was determined along those lines was that there's a fairly focused aerosol emission towards the front of the mouth, as you might imagine, and that expands to the sides actually more gradually than it does upper and lower, and especially you see that in an enclosed room. So this is another thing that some of people have seen, is that a plexiglass on either side of a person really doesn't do much. Over time, the aerosol goes forward and would probably go around in an indoor setting, any plexiglass shield, and then comes back around and up over the top. And so one of the recommendations of the study is actually to not use any of those kinds of shields within a room. Now, I'm not talking about when you're at a store and there's a plexiglass shield in front of one of the people that is working at the stores to check out sales or something like that. That's a different matter. That's in place for the safety of a droplet that would be expelled potentially. But as far as the side enclosures, that actually breaks up the air handling within the room a little bit more. And they were saying that is actually creating some dead spots where the air doesn't move as frequently, as freely as what it should. So the aerosols go in and around, and in about 10 minutes, there's really not much beyond that 6-foot range in front that you would imagine as social distancing. So 10 minutes, you know, is a pretty safe amount. If you're just even walking by somebody 6 feet away, it's going to take about 10 minutes for aerosols to get to you. Now, as it goes out in an enclosed space anyway, 30 minutes is still relatively safe. The aerosols will basically have disseminated throughout any room of a classroom size in about 30 minutes. Once you get past 30 minutes, it starts to be a little bit more diffused, I guess. It starts to mix up around itself. And once you're to an hour, it's totally saturated. So the recommendation from this study is that any rehearsal indoors should not be longer than 30 minutes.
In our last couple of minutes, so for your wind groups at Carthage for the fall, what are your tentative plans, at least in terms of rehearsing? And to any meaningful extent, are you going to try to follow another recommendation, which is that the safest place to rehearse is out of doors? Do you have any plans to try to do that?
Yes, we'll be fully outdoors, weather permitting, until mid-October, I'm assuming. Wind orchestra and concert band will both be outdoors. We will be actually just having the students bring a wire stand, a folding collapsible stand with them to an area out on the patio on the east side of the chapel. And they'll bring their music with them. And everybody will stand except the tubas and the bassoons who will need a chair. And then we'll do our rehearsal outdoors and then come back inside. They'll have plenty of time to move safely through the storage area because we're going to give them only that 30-minute rehearsal. So we've built in time on both sides for safe transfer of passage. And then also, once we get into our first concert, actually, which we are still planning for September 20th to do an outdoor Pops concert with music of Star Wars, and then also a new commissioned piece for band and carillon. But once we get into the colder months, we'll plan to move into either the chapel where we can spread out and rehearse, or we may be able to rehearse in small groups for a period of time with what's called flexible scoring, and then put it together for the performance in the last week or so.
Well, it's fascinating, all of the unprecedented challenges that are coming with COVID-19, but it's also amazing how so many great minds are coming together to try to figure out what we can do. And of course, the elimination of risk is really not an option, but right. The reduction of risk as much as possible is what we all want. And of course, it would feel so good to be making music together in a room one way or another. So I appreciate you taking the time to share the results of this really important study, which we want to add is going on from here. That is, there is more study to be undertaken and more information to be amassed. But this is a very good start, and it's been great to talk about it. Dr. James Ripley, Director of Instrumental Activities at Carthage College, thanks for being part of the morning show today. Take care.
Thank you, Greg. And I should just let the cat out of the bag. The first thing that we play this year with the group when we sit down is going to be a lovely piece by Bach, If Thou Be Near.
I look forward to that. Thank you. Tomorrow on the morning show, author Elizabeth Englander talking about her book 25 Myths About Bullying and Cyberbullying. Also tomorrow, I talk with Nick Huff and Caleb Ingen, who are part of a brand new organization called the Kenosha Opera Festival. Their plans for this summer, of course, were derailed by COVID-19, but they have organized a virtual opera concert that will be streaming on Sunday, and they'll be talking about that tomorrow.
Support for the Morning Show comes from Carthage College, home of the Aspire program and its multifaceted approach to career preparation. The new program is designed to cultivate leadership and entrepreneurial skills while empowering each Carthage student to shape a custom career development plan from their first days on campus. Learn more about the Aspire program at carthage.edu/aspire.